It's time for WK Law, the only show that looks at law from a people perspective. With your host, the partner of Wallen Clarich, Paul Wallen.
Good day, everybody. This is Paul Wallen. I'm the partner of Wallen and Clarich, and we're here today on WK Law Talk, a show where our goal is knowledge is power. The more legal knowledge you have, the more power you have when you have a legal problem to be able to solve that legal problem with the help of an experienced lawyer. Today I have on the show to start my son Matt Wallen. We're going to be talking about some major cases in the media today. And this show today is designed anybody who's either facing or is interested in crimes such as assault, battery, and of course murder. There are so many crime shows, there are so many high-profile cases that pertain to murder that we thought it'd be a good idea to properly educate the public today on what is murder and how do people defend themselves when they're accused of murder and some of the crazy results recently that jurors have been reaching. Matt, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my honor.
Great. The first thing I'd like to talk about is a case that Matt has been following extremely closely, as have millions of people who seem to be obsessed with it, and that's the Jodi Arias case. Everyone knows that Miss Arias was accused of savagely murdering her ex-boyfriend, and so many errors were made in that case. But Matt, I'd like you to please give us your take on the latest on it as it heads into the penalty phase.
Sure. As of yesterday and early into this morning, it looks as if Jodi Arias was taken off the suicide watch that she was on. Immediately upon being convicted, she went right to the media and made statements to the effect of, "I'd rather die than spend my life in prison." And as such, she went into a psychological evaluation. Looks like she's been transferred back into the general custody. And essentially, if the jury finds that she is eligible for the death penalty, she'd join a very small group of women, only one of 100 or one of three women out of 125 inmates on death row in Arizona. So we'll have to wait and see how the jury holds.
Do you think that it's likely that the jury will come back with a death verdict, or do you think there will be some kind of sympathy because of her being on the stand for 18 days? What's your take on that?
I would be shocked if the jury showed her any sympathy whatsoever at all from the beginning. She'd been doing nothing but digging a hole for herself from the initial interviews she gave to her testimony on the stand, dragging it out for 18 days. I would not be surprised if they did find that she was eligible for the death penalty.
You know, one thing that happened in this case that we see very often that ends up hurting our clients in almost any criminal case is the fact that Miss Arias, for reasons only she can explain, chose to go on a nationally televised interview and give a statement as to what she claims happened for the entire world to view. And she had spoken to the police on videotape. And both of those versions were different than the version of testimony she gave at the trial. So you can only imagine the jurors being confused, trying to figure out how can we possibly believe her when this is at least the third, if not the fourth or fifth version of the case. Don't you agree that was probably a bad choice?
That's absolutely right. Everyone throws around the saying, what you say can and will be used against you. If anyone needs an example, just cite this case. She did an extended interview with 48 hours, probably maybe 30, 45 minutes. However, it was dissected by the prosecutor, and an introduction of evidence was about 1 or 2 minutes where they dissected the parts that could be used against her in front of the jury. Nothing she said that was potentially favorable was obviously offered into evidence. So you got to keep your mouth shut when it comes to speaking to law enforcement, without a doubt.
Okay, well, we're going to be coming back after the break, and we're going to be talking a little more about Arias, and then we're going to talk about O.J. Simpson and his last Hail Mary attempt to get out of jail. You're on WK Law Talk, and we'll be back after the break.
You've been charged with a crime, and now you're facing the loss of your freedom. Where do you turn to get out of jail or stay out of jail? The law offices of Wallen and Clarich. Call 877-4-NO-JAIL. With over 20 years' experience and attorneys who work in your local courts, Wallen and Claridge can make the difference between jail and freedom. When you need help, make one call. Make it to Wallen and Claridge. 877-4-NO-JAIL. The call is free. Will you be?
Hey, are you okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm fine.
17 to Central Jail.
If you've been arrested for DUI and are facing DMV and court hearings, it could mean losing your license, your job, and even your freedom. But Wallen and Claridge can help. Just call 877-4-NO-JAIL. With attorneys who know your local courts, Wallen and Claridge can make the difference between jail and freedom. Call Wallen and Claridge at 877-4-NO-JAIL. The call is free. Will you be?
Yeah, warning. Your life can change.
I just, one day was going to work in the morning and opened the door and there's police officers there.
We treat you like a member of our family.
You guys kept in touch with me, always kept me updated on everything.
We can make the difference in your case.
When I was in jail, I interviewed 30 different attorneys and felt nothing was happening with any of them.
We always fight for your freedom.
You know, without Wallen and Claridge, I don't think that the outcome would have been the same.
Let Wallen and Claridge make the difference for you and your family. We will get through this together.
And now let's get back to Paul Wallen and his guest.
We're back on WK Law Talk, and I'm here with my son, Matt Wallen, a brilliant criminal defense attorney at Wallen and Claridge, and we're talking about the Jody Arias case. One of the pieces of advice that my partner Steve Claridge has sort of made famous at our firm is when someone asks us whether or not they should speak to the police, my partner often says, and we echo, there's six words of advice that we give people. Shut up, and shut up. Because the only thing you can do to hurt yourself when the police want to talk to you, when you're a suspect in a criminal case, is kill yourself if you choose to talk to the police. Thus, keep your mouth shut. Exercise your legal right. Contact our office or another gifted criminal defense firm, and we will guide from there. The prosecution wins cases primarily because of the stupidity of accused people who speak to them and do not exercise their right to remain silent. Something Jody Arias has now learned a very hard lesson. Right, Matt?
Absolutely.
Another thing we'd like to talk about today is one of the greatest football players of all time who has had a very troubled 20 years. O.J. Simpson is back in the news and in a very, very interesting way. Everyone knows that O.J. Simpson was accused of murdering his wife as well as another gentleman. And he was found not guilty in one of the most shocking verdicts that Los Angeles has ever heard. And then he was recently convicted in Las Vegas in 2008 of robbery when he was attempting to get back some of his memorabilia. Now he's filed a writ of habeas corpus asking for to get a new trial because at a new trial he would, of course, have a chance of winning. And he's basing the new trial motion on the fact that his lawyer was incompetent. While some experts have said he has little chance of prevailing, he does make some very, very interesting arguments. One of the arguments is that his lawyer did not allow him to testify at the trial. And Matt will tell you that it's extremely important for a defendant to have that choice. Correct, Matt?
Absolutely. It's the defendant's absolute right to testify on his or her behalf. There's extensive parts of trial that go to ensuring that the defendant has been advised of such a right. Generally, the judge will admonish him in court, making sure that counsel has advised him fully about his absolute right to testify. And at the same time, that decision of whether to testify is a very strategic decision, as we've seen in the crossover between, for example, Jody Arias, who did testify, in Casey Anthony, who did not. It's a huge, huge decision in the case, and we would hope that Yale Gallanter, the original counsel for Simpson, did give him ample legal advice that didn't conflict with his interests, but that's what's going to be flushed out here in the hearings in Nevada.
O.J. Simpson is claiming that he wanted very badly to testify and that Gallanter told him he could not testify, and the law is clear This is one area where the lawyer, no matter how good the lawyer claims to be, cannot make the decision. A defendant has an absolute right to testify, even if it's over his lawyer's objection. So if the judge at this hearing believes O.J. Simpson's version of events, that he was denied the right to testify, it could mean, among other issues that are pending, that he could get a new trial. O.J. Simpson also claims that his lawyer failed to get investigators to investigate the case properly. There was a tape recording in the hotel room, and O.J. Simpson was told by Galanter, according to what Simpson reports, that he would get an investigator who was an expert in analyzing the tape recording to see if it was doctored. That apparently didn't happen. One of the things you learn first day as a criminal defense attorney is investigation is everything. You need to bring forth evidence that can help acquit your client. And if in fact the judge believes that Galanter failed to do proper investigation, it could be another reason why O.J. Simpson could receive a new trial. Basically, the judge is going to be the judgment on credibility, of course, and will have to decide who to believe. And of course, O.J. Simpson has a very, very tall mountain to climb because he's in prison, and people that are in prison often will say anything to get out of prison. There are other issues pending in that case, though it'll be fascinating to watch. It's supposed to take about a week, and then we'll find out if O.J. Simpson gets another trial. It's still unlikely, but I would not close the door on it.
One small victory that he did gain was that he was allowed to have one hand unshackled to drink water and take notes. So I'm not sure that's going to do too much for his case, but every year of the 65 years he's been alive is now showing, so it's very interesting to see how this case will develop.
If he is, if his motion is denied based on the sentence he received of 9 to 33 years, it is reported that he'll have to do at least another 3 or 4 more years before he'll be eligible for parole, which will make him a relatively old man and a beaten down man with all of this horrible events that have gone on in his life. One would argue poor judgment, of course. Many people believe that he should be in prison for the homicide of 2 people in Los Angeles, but there was a $33 million verdict that the jurors determined he was responsible for his wife's death and Goldman's death. And one of the reasons he got in trouble in Nevada was because he keeps running from having to not pay that civil judgment. And of course, he doesn't have many ways to make money that they're not after him to collect that judgment. So we wish O.J. Simpson the best, but justice will prevail. Another major issue came out today that Matt is very familiar with, related to DUIs, that we need to discuss because so many people get arrested for DUI and are very worried about whether or not they've drank too much and are okay to drive. The National Safety Board today came out with a recommendation that the law in all states, including California, should lower the blood alcohol rate of a DUI from its current 0.08 down to 0.05. The theory behind it is that over 100 countries have done this, and over the last 10 years, they have determined that the death rate from DUI fatalities has been cut in more than half. But a major issue that I'd like you to address, Matt, is what does it take for a person to get to a 0.05, and how will that change things drastically in California if that level is reduced?
Absolutely. The latest news that we're hearing kind of confirms what many in the defense field feared, where we're getting towards a zero tolerance policy. Where you can't even have a sip of wine with dinner and drive. It seems like each day more and more lobbyists and groups are trying to do their best to chip away at the 0.08, which in of itself is quite an arbitrary number. In terms of 0.05, any time that you're trying to determine one's blood alcohol content, you want to look at, of course, what they consumed over what period of time and also how much the person weighs. So, for example, a 0.05 for someone who weighs 160 to 180 pounds is 1 to 2 drinks. A lot of that will depend on food concurrent with alcohol. A lot of that gets into specifics of the toxicology. But the bottom line is 0.05 is closer to one drink than it is to three or four. So this is a very interesting development in the law.
So if your wife says to you, when you tell her she shouldn't be driving, and she said, I only had one wine, she's probably going to expose herself to being arrested for a DUI, potentially, if they lower this rate of 2.05.
Absolutely. It's very, very difficult without a portable breath device or something of that nature to guesstimate what your blood alcohol level is. With the way that alcohol rises, peaks, and then falls, it's extremely difficult just to monitor, just based on what you ate and drank, exactly where you're at. And I have so many clients in my office who say, Matt, I had no idea I was over the legal limit. And that will simply increase if the limit goes down from 0.08 to 0.05.
This change in the law would probably bring a lot of new business to Wallen and Claridge, because I'm betting that it would increase the number of arrests dramatically if that happened in California, correct?
Absolutely. The difficulty, I believe, for the state would be proving impairment. The 0.08 is currently what they call the per se level. So unlike drugs, if someone has a drug in their system, there is currently in California no per se level of, for example, marijuana, where the state could say the defendant has this amount of marijuana, so he's therefore impaired. Alcohol, they've already designated 0.08 as that amount. So if we get to 0.05, I do believe that more people will be coming through our doors, but I don't know if the state's going to be able to convict each and every one of these people that are arrested.
Well, that's a fascinating discussion about DUI. We'll have to watch if California is willing to go that way. And I'm sure MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, will have their say advocating for that position. It will sure be interesting. We're going to be back in a little while talking after the break about a critical area, assault and battery. It's a fascinating area of law. And stay tuned. We're at WK Law Talk.
You've been charged with a crime, and now you're facing the loss of your freedom. Where do you turn to get out of jail or stay out of jail? The law offices of Wallen and Claridge. Call 877-4-NO-JAIL. With over 20 years' experience and attorneys who work in your local courts, Wallen and Claridge can make the difference between jail and freedom. When you need help, make one call. Make it to Wallen and Claridge. 877-4-NO-JAIL. The call is free. Will you be?
Hey, are you okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm fine.
17 to Central Jail.
If you've been arrested for DUI and are facing DMV and court hearings, it could mean losing your license, your job, and even your freedom. But Wallen and Claridge can help. Just call 877-4-NO-JAIL. With attorneys who know your local courts, Wallen and Claridge can make the difference between jail and freedom. Call Wallen and Claridge at 877-4-NO-JAIL. The call is free. Will you be?
Without warning, your life can change.
I just one day was going to work in the morning and opened the door. There's police officers there.
We treat you like a member of our family.
You guys kept in touch with me, always kept me updated on everything.
We can make the difference in your case.
When I was in jail, I interviewed 30 different attorneys and felt nothing was happening with any of them.
We always fight for your freedom.
You know, without Wallen and Claridge, I don't think that the outcome would have been the same.
Let Wallen and Claridge make the difference for you and your family. We will get through this together.
And now back to Paul and his guest.
We're back on WK Law Talk with brilliant criminal defense attorney Matt Wallen. This segment is going to be dedicated to everything you would need to know, whether you are accused or even a victim of assault and battery. There's no crime in California that Wallen and Claridge receives more calls on than this crime. From people that get into an altercation at a bar, to husband and wife who get into an altercation, to people that get out of control at a sporting event, or a softball game, or even a kid's baseball game. Seems people love to touch people angrily. And it causes them to get arrested and then to face criminal prosecution. So, Matt, you're an expert, and I'd like to ask you to explain first what is an assault and what is a battery and what is the difference.
Absolutely. A lot of times in the law, people use these two words, assault and battery, interchangeably, but in reality, in California, they're two separate and distinct crimes, designated by Penal Code 240, which covers assault, and 242, which covers simple battery. I think the simplest way to look at it is an assault is an instance where the defendant places another in reasonable apprehension of some sort of offensive touching. On the other hand, a battery is the actual intentional, harmful, or offensive contact with another person. So the main difference between the two is assault is generally an attempted battery, whereas a battery is in essence a completed assault. So for an assault to be charged and potentially convicted upon, there does not need to be actual contact. So that's the distinction between the two right there.
So if I take a swing at someone intending to hit them and hurt them, but the person ducks and I miss them, have I committed a crime?
Under the law, you've technically committed a crime in that you've acted in a way that your conduct would naturally and directly result in the application of force to a person. You're not going to be benefit with the fact that that individual or victim had the wherewithal to duck. You're going to be held liable, criminally and potentially civilly, for your violent conduct. And how you're prosecuted is why this area of the law is so very interesting and why it has so many crossovers, because prosecutors and police can arrest and prosecutors can charge you with a whole host of different charges ranging from a misdemeanor to a felony or a felony with a strike attached to it for great bodily injury. So it covers a wide spectrum of criminal offenses.
So if that person ducked and I missed him, would I be prosecuted for assault?
You could absolutely be prosecuted for assault, whereas if you had contacted that person, you would most likely be prosecuted for battery, and depending on the level of injury and various other factors like your prior criminal history, that will influence how the case is filed.
And if, in fact, you are arrested, you will often have to post bail to get out?
Absolutely. Oftentimes, the police, in conjunction with a detention release officer, will set a bail amount based upon the conduct and the arrest, and that person will have to post that bail in order to be released during the pendency of their case.
If that person didn't duck quick enough, and I swung at him, and I hit him in the nose, and he got a bloody nose, then what happens?
In that case, most likely, since there was actual harmful conduct or contact, that person would be charged with a battery. At what degree would depend on, again, the level of injury, and also who the victim is. Is the victim a spouse? Is the victim a minor? And that's when all the various defenses come into play that we'll address.
If, in fact, the person that you hit is your spouse or a significant other or someone that lives in your home, are you now facing an entirely different crime?
You are. You're now going to come under Penal Code 243, particularly 243E1. That's battery against a spouse or someone that you live with. And it's actually an increased punishment from a general battery that you might see in, let's say, a bar fight. The maximum is for a misdemeanor battery against a spouse is a year, whereas a simple assault or a simple battery is 6 months in county jail.
And in fact, if it's that 243 charge where you've struck a spouse, doesn't that carry with it a major problem of a protective order?
Absolutely, and that's what we were addressing earlier in terms of the crossover when we talk about assault and battery. If you come within the 243 battery against a spouse, you're now in the world of domestic violence, or DV as we refer to it, and with the domestic violence comes a protective order, which is going to be served on the defendant and the aggrieved party, usually the spouse or girlfriend, which is going to prohibit any contact between the parties. Sometimes children are even mentioned, or minors, meaning that the person being charged has to keep their distance from all parties, and that can cause whole host of problems for people.
So if I was to push my spouse in an argument, get prosecuted for that, I could be banned from my house or seeing my kids?
Absolutely. The next thing you know, you'd be served with what's called an emergency protective order, which would mean that you immediately have to vacate not only the premises, but any contact with your spouse. If you run into the person somewhere out, it's your duty to leave and to retreat. So So your life can be turned upside down with a simple dial of 911 and an allegation of some sort of physical conduct or contact, even if no injury results. And that's what's important to understand. You notice that when I said the definitions for assault and battery, neither mentioned anything about the necessity that there be visible or severe damage. All that does, if there is serious or great bodily injury, it just enhances the level of the offense, which exposes the defendant to significantly more custody time and additional penalties.
If the person who's been restrained violates that order and does come in contact with his spouse or kids, what happens then?
That person now facing a new charge, which would be a charge for violating a protective order, which in of itself is a separate misdemeanor charge, which could land the person in custody. And of course, they would still be facing the underlying case of domestic violence. So when you pick up a domestic violence case, you're really picking up the whole realm of protective orders and restraining orders, which is a very, very convoluted area of the law. And that's why you need a very experienced firm and advocate to guide you through the process.
What is the punishment that the judge can give someone if they were to be convicted for misdemeanor assault or battery?
For simple misdemeanor assault and battery, generally, it's going to be 6 months in custody. However, if the assault happens on an officer or a firefighter, that may elevate, assuming it's a misdemeanor, to 1 year. So generally, if the case is filed as a misdemeanor, you're looking at 6 months or 1 year.
And you've handled many, many of these cases, correct?
Absolutely.
Can you tell me what you do when someone is accused of this offense to successfully defend them so they can avoid jail time or avoid a criminal record? What steps do you take and what results do you achieve?
Absolutely. Whenever a client retains me for an assault or battery type case, these cases are unique in the sense that oftentimes the entire contents of the police report or the allegations are just the alleged victim's account. It comes down to oftentimes a he said, she said, or a he said argument. And whenever you have a case like that, it's up to you to retain an attorney that you believe can aggressively advance your interests and put forward the true facts. So when you hear about a fight outside of a sporting event or at a bar, first thing that comes to mind is, well, number one, was my client defending himself or defending someone else? And if my client had a reasonable and honest belief that he or someone close to him was going to be seriously injured, you do have a right to defend yourself. Oftentimes, these situations will be mutual combat where we'll find out that the reason that the victim made the report is out of fear that they would be charged with the crime. So I'm going to go through the whole host of defenses with my clients, whether or not they actually had the present ability to commit an assault, whether or not they intended to commit an assault, and make sure that I flush out any false or unsubstantiated allegations by an alleged victim.
What can you do in a case where, in fact, your client did get out of control and did assault or batter another person?
Sure.
What kind of alternative punishments have you been able to achieve for your clients so they don't lose their job and they don't go to jail?
Sure. Oftentimes, I'm able to reach agreements with the prosecutor's office that could range anywhere from an anger management program, a 10-week anger management class. In addition, oftentimes, what's called a civil compromise under Penal Code 1377 can be reached between my client and the alleged victim or victim, where they're covered for whatever physical or emotional trauma they may have suffered, and as a result, that could lead to the prosecutor dropping and dismissing all charges. So just because someone has been involved in a fight, or maybe they got out of line and they did something that would rise the level of an assault or even a battery, that's where my job begins right then, not ends. It begins by advocating for my client.
And if a person is able, through your assistance, to obtain a civil compromise, what will that do to their criminal record or lack thereof?
Well, it protected it from being tarnished, because a civil compromise on its face is a compromise and agreement to drop the case, meaning a financial amount would make the victim whole again, and there would be no conviction, which would protect my client's criminal record.
How important is it when you're defending someone to learn about their prior history, the things they've done in their life and their prior criminal record, and what impact do those things have on the judge's decision in terms of sentencing?
It's extremely important that I run through with my clients. I like to call it a social history. I want to know about, of course, their criminal record. I also want to know about the good things about them. How do they contribute to society? Are they gainfully employed? Perhaps they're seeing a therapist or they're part of an organization. All of this background is how I separate my clients from the other 50 defendants that are in court. And it's why I give my clients special attention that they deserve. And the way I'm able to present my clients to the prosecutor or the judge is by getting in touch with them emotionally and gain understanding of where they're coming from. Because oftentimes, regardless of how bad someone's conduct is, there's motivating factors behind it that I need to, as an effective advocate, be able to identify and flush out for the court.
And do you first approach the prosecutor in an attempt to get the case dismissed or reduced? How does that work?
Yeah, most often in a case, it will commence by me engaging the prosecutor. What people don't understand is that offers can come from both the judge or the prosecutor, and they can supersede each other. So depending on how my negotiations go with the prosecutor, that will guide me towards whether or not I may need to go meet with the judge in chambers to negotiate an offer with the judge. But normally it'll commence with negotiations with the assigned prosecutor or their office.
Are character references important in some cases?
Sure, absolutely. A DA is, their job by definition is to protect the public. So when I'm able to produce letters from the public and from people associated with my client, what it does is it alleviates some of the concerns they have about my client reoffending or being a danger to society. When I have five people from his work, five people from his school who are willing to step up and advocate for him in a written form, I welcome those character letters.
And they are helpful then?
Absolutely.
Now, what happens in a case where the injuries are sort of severe and maybe your client has a checkered past where maybe he has a prior bar fight and the judge says that he has to impose some incarceration time? Can you tell our listeners what you have been able to do in the past to avoid doing jail time in the jail as opposed to alternative sentencing that's available?
Absolutely. Probably the number one thing I hear from my clients when I get down to business and ask them what they're looking to get out of my representation and work with our law office is they want to remain free from custody. So what I'll do in the case is you have to continue to work the case to its fullest. And when you're able to lock down a great offer for the client, for example, what you'll want to do is you'll all try to convert any jail time that's asked for into an alternative such as house arrest or secured electronic confinement where my clients can work from home while they work off their custody time. There's also weekend jail or a private jail where my clients can turn themselves in on the weekends. My clients who have high-level jobs simply cannot afford to be placed in custody. So once I'm able to negotiate a very favorable outcome, perhaps they can do jail in a private jail, which is a better facility than a standard county jail. They can do house arrest, sometimes work it off through community service or other physical labor. So there's all sorts of alternatives that can be explored.
And you've been able to accomplish this for many of your clients, right?
Most definitely, yes.
Okay. Well, Matt, obviously, if anyone gets accused of assault and battery, they clearly know who to go to, because obviously you know your stuff.
I appreciate that.
Thank you very much for coming on the show today. And after the commercial, we're going to be talking with Andre Lapine, a brilliant criminal defense attorney from our firm, talking about murder. See you after the break.
You've been charged with a crime, and now you're facing the loss of your freedom. Where do you turn to get out of jail or stay out of jail? The law offices of Wallen and Claridge. Call 877-4-NO-JAIL. With over 20 years' experience and attorneys who work in your local courts, Wallen and Claridge can make the difference between jail and freedom. When you need help, make one call. Make it to Wallen and Claridge. 877-4-NO-JAIL. The call is free. Will you be?
Hey, are you okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm fine.
17 to Central Jail.
If you've been arrested for DUI and are facing DMV and court hearings, it could mean losing your license, your job, and even your freedom. But Wallen and Claridge can help. Just call 877-4-NO-JAIL. With attorneys who know your local courts, Wallen and Claridge can make the difference between jail and freedom. Call Wallen and Claridge at 877-4-NO-JAIL. The call is free. Will you be?
Without warning, your life can change.
I just, one day, was going to work in the morning and opened the door. There's police officers there.
We treat you like a member of our family.
You guys kept in touch with me, always kept me updated on everything.
We can make the difference in your case.
When I was in jail, I interviewed 30 different attorneys and felt nothing was happening with any of them.
We always fight for your freedom.
You know, without Wallen and Claridge, I don't think that the outcome would have been the same.
Let Wallen and Claridge make the difference for you and your family. We will get through this together.
And now back to Paul and his next guest.
We're back on WK Law Talk, and I am very privileged to have Andre Lapine, a brilliant criminal defense attorney at Wallen and Claridge for many years, to help me educate everyone today on the topic of murder. Hi, Andre.
How you doing, Paul?
Fine. Andre, can you tell us a little bit about yourself in terms of how many years you've been with us and the kind of cases you handle?
Yeah, sure. I've been with Wallen and Claridge since March of 2007. I've handled hundreds of cases with the firm, ranging from small-time traffic matters all the way up to cases where people are facing the potential of life in prison. So it kind of runs the gamut, a lot of DUI cases, as you can imagine, and then just any other type of criminal case that we retain.
Okay. I wanted to ask you some questions today about homicide and educate the public, if we can, about various aspects of cases where people get accused of murder, because there's a range of murder charges, and I want to go over those with you. First of all, when a person gets arrested for murder, it gets tremendous media attention. Why do you think that is?
Well, murder is the ultimate criminal act. There's nothing more significant than that, than taking someone's life. And the American culture has been fascinated with murder cases. Going all the way back to the beginning of Hollywood, Perry Mason, for example, other courtroom type dramas. These have always been popular in American media, because murder is a sensational act, and the courtroom drama that follows, if in fact the case goes to trial, is very intriguing. So I think people really latch onto it, and I think they get personally involved in it quite a bit. So when you're talking about murder cases, I think as far as courtroom dramas go, it's the as good as it gets.
Yeah, and you can tell by the Arias and the publicity the Arias trial got, all the way back to O.J. Simpson's trial and the Casey Anthony trial. It seems that it just media loves it because they know the public loves to watch it, and that gets them ratings. And
that's exactly that. You just hit it on the head. That's what it's all about. It's about ratings, obviously, and those cases are very good examples of ones where people really get personally invested in the cases.
Exactly.
And then it's just a 24/7 thing, especially with the news cycles these days. Nothing more fun for the person at home to watch than a murder trial, something like that, where and you're talking about Jodi Arias and Casey Anthony. Those cases had it all. So it's just fascinating for people to get into.
Exactly. When a person gets arrested for a crime such as murder, is the person entitled to bail, or do they have to stay in custody throughout the whole case?
It depends. There are different degrees of murder. First degree murder, they're looking at typically life without parole or the death penalty. When that's the case, there's no bail almost in any county in California. Now, if it's second degree murder, where they're looking at 15 to life, the typical bail schedule for California counties, particularly in Southern California, is $1 million. So it does depend on what they're being charged with, whether it's premeditated first-degree murder or some other type of second-degree murder.
And if a person is facing second-degree murder and the bail is $1 million, does that mean they have to post $1 million cash to get out, or is there a way to get out other than that?
No, they could, but most people obviously aren't in a position to do that. There are other ways to post it. You can work through a bondsman, typically with a referral from a lawyer. You'd pay 8% of the $1 million, so you'd be looking at $80,000. Then there are other ways to do it by using equity in your home, things of that nature. Since the financial crisis with house values going down, less people are in a position to do that now. The bottom line is you don't have to post the full million. There are ways to get someone out of custody who's facing, second degree murder charges, but still it would take a significant amount of money to make that happen.
And if I understand you correctly, on $1 million bail, you'd have to pay a bail bondsman a fee of $80,000 that you don't get back?
Well, that's true, but they buy you your freedom while you're fighting the case, and they also take the risk. They put up the full million with the court, so that if something happens and you don't make your court appearances or you flee somehow, then they're on the hook for $1 million. So it's a big gamble for a bondsman to put up that kind of money, that type of bail, and almost certainly they'd require some sort of tracking device to be worn or something of that nature to protect their investment, essentially.
If a client comes to Wallen and Klarich and is accused of murder, can we go to court and ask the court to have a bail hearing and ask the court to lower the bail?
You can. Now, what I discussed, the $1 million, that's presumptive bail. And the purposes of bail, really aren't to punish the defendant. There are two main considerations that the court takes into consideration. One is whether the person's a flight risk, and two, whether they're a risk to public safety. Those are supposed to be the two things that weigh the most. Now, if there are certain special circumstances, maybe the defendant has medical issues or a number of things, a number of variables could play into it, where you could have good grounds for a judge to reduce the bail. But you also have to understand that a judge, may be disinclined to reduce bail out of fear that if he does release a defendant, maybe the defendant flees or, kill somebody else or hurt somebody else or does something that makes the judge, that's why judges are a little hesitant to do that in some cases. But it's a case-by-case thing, and certainly there have been cases where there were good reasons for the bail to be reduced, and we've been successful in getting that done.
And if a person's accused of murder and they're in custody, or out of custody for that matter, how long does it take from the time a person's arrested, commonly, before the case would go to trial, if it goes to trial?
On murder cases, it typically takes a lot longer than your, garden variety criminal case. It could be anywhere between 1 year to, two, three, sometimes even 4 years. And I believe that was the case with Jody Arias.
So if a person is accused of murder and is wrongfully accused of murder and doesn't have a lot of money, they are going to be in custody, losing years of their life, waiting to go to trial to be found innocent. Right.
Right. And there are procedural safeguards in place. The person who's accused has a right to a preliminary hearing, technically within 10 days of the date that they're arrested, 10 court days. Now, oftentimes the defendant will waive that right so that the defendant's attorney can do their job in building up the defense. But the preliminary hearing is a probable cause hearing, and it's just to ensure that people aren't held without any sort of cause for trial. At a preliminary hearing, the DA, the district attorney, would have to show that there's probable cause to believe that a crime was committed and that the defendant committed it. So there are safeguards in place to make sure that people aren't held in jail indefinitely, pending trial, without any sort of hearing at all. But again, for a preliminary hearing, the burden's pretty low for the DA, and they typically get holding orders for the person to stand trial.
When a client comes to Wallen and Klarich and hires us on a murder case, as many, many people have done, what steps do we take to aggressively defend them?
Well, the first thing you want to do is go see that client. They'll likely be in custody at that point in time. You want to see that person in a private setting, discuss all the facts and circumstances that they know that got them to be in custody. You certainly want to communicate to them that they shouldn't talk about the case at all to anybody, including family, fellow inmates, or anyone else, because talking about the case is always a bad idea. It's not going to do any good, and it can only hurt the case. And then from there, we want to contact either the arresting detectives or the arresting agency, whoever the arresting officers might be, or the district attorney's office, depending on what stage it's at, whether the police reports have been handed over to the district attorney's office, just to try to elicit as much information as possible as we can about the case. And then from there, we typically want to hire a private investigator of our own as soon as possible to start investigating the facts of the case and building up the defense.
In many cases, our clients will have a defense that we can raise of self-defense if a person dies after some kind of mutual combat, correct?
Yes.
And in those cases, are character witnesses important?
Absolutely. Character witnesses are always important in that type of case, because if we can demonstrate that our client does not have any history of violence whatsoever, is a peaceful person, and it would be out of character for them to act in a way that's aggressive towards other people, that's admissible, and that can convince jurors potentially that our client the defense of self-defense is appropriate, that it fits. And, obviously if we can show that, you put up 5-10 people who know the client, who've known him for a long time, that say the client couldn't hurt a fly, that not an aggressive person, in no way, shape, or form could they have done this, with any sort of aggressive outlook, then that can be very relevant in trying to convince a jury of your defendant's innocence.
And the defense of self-defense in itself means that you had the lawful right to use deadly force.
It's what's called a justifiable homicide. It's not saying that there isn't, there wasn't a homicide because someone was killed. It's saying that there was justification for it. That under the eyes of the law, it's a justifiable homicide, and it is a self-defense is definitely something that we have to look at, depending on the facts and circumstances of the case.
And even self-defense can act also as a defense, even if you're defending someone else, if you believe that person's life was in jeopardy due to the conduct of the alleged victim, right?
Yeah, that'd be defense of others. Yeah, absolutely. And depending on the circumstances, again, if for example, you witness you're driving on the road and you see an altercation on the side of the road, and you see someone taking a crowbar to another person's head. If you take out a gun and shoot that person, there are good chance that you would raise the defense of others, because the person who was beating the person over the head with a crowbar would in all likelihood kill them if they continue to do that. And if you don't act in that situation, there would be a dead person there. So in a type of situation like that, defense of others defense could work. Again, it's going to be a case-by-case thing, and our job is to evaluate the facts and circumstances of the case and see what kind of defenses are reasonable and that a reasonable jury might consider in acquitting your client.
Exactly. Well, Andre, thank you very much. I wanted to thank you for coming on the show, because so many people are confused about what they can do when they're accused of such a serious crime, and you explained it so well. Thank you very much for coming on the show today.
No problem. Thanks, Paul.
Sure. Bye. I wanted everyone to know that when someone you love is accused of a serious crime such as murder, what is going on is very emotional for the entire family. And the law firm that you select to defend your loved one needs to be a law firm that you get a sense really cares about the defendant and what the entire family is going through. As you heard from Mr. Lapine, this is absolutely a team effort, and you need a law firm that you can trust. And please call us if you have any question you have at 877-4-NO-JAIL, 877-466-5245. If you have any question about these crimes we've talked about or any crimes, because we're here to help you and we care. And we really appreciate you coming on, listening to the show today, because the whole idea behind WK Law Talk is to educate the public about their legal rights so they can protect themselves if they find themselves in a legal jam. So we look forward to coming on to listening to our show next week. It's WK Law Talk, and we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to WK Law, the only show that looks at law from a people perspective, with your host, Paul Wallen, Wallen and Claridge.